gray skies at Stinson Beach if you went away. Maybe you would never return. Some days you thought, if the sun comes out, I may stay. And you walked the surf's edge with a few of your boys, and as the waves crashed and echoed, you said it was the sound of the gopis beating hearts in separation from Krishna. And in the evenings in your house, you held dancing bhajans and debates against the Mayavadis. Beneath the crude painting of Lord Chaitanya in Kirtan, with Kartamashayi on your right, on the last night, humbly you asked the devotees to work together and never leave. They should not take it as just some fun, but should live as a spiritual family and work to spread the message as you had given. In your room, while your servants packed your bags, you chanted on the beads of new initiates, staying up late to add as many as possible into your family, the Hare Krishna movement. Swamiji's departure. It was too soon for him to leave them, but Krishna had arranged it, so his followers were resigned. Either I will die there, or I have work to do to make an American house for training the Western students. But he was also sad, bound with deep affection for the transformed boys and girls, completely dependent on him. And the question remained, could they go on without him? The gopis had reasoned with Krishna, "Do you think it is right that you leave us like this?" But the New York disciples did not accuse as he embraced them in a last farewell. Yet the question remained, would he ever return? With a chudder neatly draped over his shoulder and the same umbrella in his hand, he flew away on Air India. Already he had given them lifetimes of work, and as his plane flew into the rainy night, they turned back to their duties, fingering their beads and chanting. This time they had not forgotten to keep his picture. Return and return, India and the West. Hare Krishna chanting had gone with Bhaktivedanta Swami to the West, and now he was returning. At 2 a.m. in Delhi heat, arriving at his Chippiwada, turning on the electric light, the room was as he'd left it 2 years ago. Over here was my cooker and typewriter. I would cook and type and sleep and type. He had come for health, but he got worse, a fever. He struggled to Vrindavan and there recovered in his rooms at Radha Damodar. "I am here," wrote Kirtanananda, "with beloved Swamiji in Vrindavan with the trees and the peacocks, and everywhere devotees wearing tilak and temples, but I can honestly say I like our kirtans better in New York." Prabhupada also wrote, "I cannot stop my Western world activities. I will come to you again." 110-degree weather agreed with him. He felt his health returning and thought of going back. "Vrindavan is inspiration only. Even if I die, you are my future hopes, and you will do it." Weather and illness got the American boys depressed, and Prabhupada wondered how he could start an American house if they could not live here. He had always thought of how to do something great for Krishna. Before, it had been theoretical, the League of Devotees, but now ISKCON was a fact and growing. Reports had reached him of chanting in Mexico, Holland, and England, and it would spread everywhere as the spiritual culture traveled among the youth of the world. He was the same person as before, making plans, but with a foothold now, and followers to return to. Even in Vrindavan, they were on his mind. Light blue aerograms floated in from the West, filled with urgent pleas for his return. Television appearances scheduled, quarrels needing his mediation, and hearts feeling empty without him. Affairs in ISKCON were somehow going on, but everything called for his personal attention. "Don't worry," he said, "I am definitely coming back, just trying to get the visa and a flight." He had no plan to retire, although sometimes he would mention it when in a certain mood. But now his aim was clear: to recover in Vrindavan's warmth and then return. Calcutta, Tokyo, San Francisco, to every town and village in the world. Waiting for you in Boston. We were always thinking of you, Prabhupada, although sometimes I was too ashamed to even look at your picture. But we wanted you to come back, and you very kindly wrote that you wanted to join us and give us typing tasks. You gave us the feeling we were something worthy, and that when you came back, we could work along with you in your mission. In Calcutta, you sized up the situation again. India was not making spiritual progress, or even maintaining her original culture. In the West, you had already seen 100% rascaldom. Krishna consciousness was the crucial need, and only you could supply it. As it was when you were in India, readying to come back, so it is now. All the worldwide devotees are your assistants, and ISKCON, although growing, is still at its beginning, and still it is the only way out of the dungeon of demons.
Mahaprabhu kirtan nitya gita baditra majjanana chorasena ramanchakam pasu taranga bhaju bande gurachi charanarabindam Sharada Vanala Nira Loka Nanaya Karina Ghana Ghana Tyam Vata Chakalan Gunarna Vasha Vande Gura Sri Charanara Vindam
San Francisco Homecoming, December 1967. He was always golden, but from months of the sunshine of India, he was tanner, and his step was lively. He had purchased saris for the girls and silk garlands for Lord Jagannath. With these items in his bag, along with cartels and a coconut grater, he had passed through the immigration and customs line, carrying his sannyas danda. He hadn't come back for money, for enjoying the senses, or for Hindu conversions. He saw America in a spiritual way. When the TV reporter asked him what was his complaint against America, he replied, "I have no complaint. Rather, they are taking to it." The important thing was to convince his students to start more centers and print more books. He was ambitious, but grateful of even the smallest, genuine increments in service to the Lord. He was pleased to see that in his absence an infant was born to Krishna-conscious parents. "I will take her to Vrindavan," he said, and threw flowers on her crib. He had Krishna, the Supreme, and the association of Lord Chaitanya, and he gave that wealth liberally, as a surabi gives milk. Thus he returned, his plans only beginning, for the Krishna-consciousness movement. First time in Los Angeles, spring 1968. In L.A. and ISKCON first, divorce, American style. This is all nonsense, Prabhupada said. I will simply go back to Vrindavan and sit and chant Hare Krishna. Why should I deal with this quarrel between husband and wife? This is not the business of a sannyasi. His health was still not good, a ringing in his ear, yet he went on working, preaching even in his dreams. He was more than a sannyasi. Natural commentaries based on Shastra came from his lotus lips, not only in the hours of lecture, but always. He gave the Krishna-conscious conclusion. On a front lawn in the Watts suburb, he sat under a tree, like a sage of old. Whatever happiness you have felt, he said, you simply tell someone else. That is all you have to do. Boston, May 1968. While I stood by cooking, you stood in the kitchen of the old house and looked at the poster. The spiritual master of the holy name is coming to Boston. You smiled and said, a month's engagement, the perfection of my life. Northeastern University. Even today, that place is the worst for Sankirtan. Yet you drew a full chapel. The students were not serious, but they filled the hall to see a Swami from India. I put the garland around your neck and played the drum, thrilled and proud. I knew what you said was true and that you were my spiritual master. You began by thanking them for the opportunity to glorify the Supreme Lord. In the lecture, you mentioned the sun god Vivasvan. You cannot disbelieve it. 15 devotees were sitting beside you. We felt we were guarding you past the bronze husky, through the throngs of students, across the paved urban campus. But you were guarding us. In a university alien to your spirit, you had kindly attended and now led us back to the cars and back to the house. Boston, you was a flop. And I was to blame. But I remember you. Thousands of students riding on the trolleys, walking in and out of gray-faced buildings, girlfriends and boyfriends with books, sitting and talking in luncheonettes, but only a dozen in Marsh Chapel with you. On a table draped with a white cloth, you sat. Another good, full lecture. And you, leading kirtan, playing the cartels in a mounting beat. A sophomore Advaitavadi stood and challenged the big, empty chapel. It was a flop, but you were with us. And we were the ones who heard what you said, who accompanied you, who loved you as you blessed each place. At MIT, in the posh student lounge, my reputation was saved when 150 attended. As always, you spoke perfect truth, but with a special dose for the scientists. This is MIT, you said, but where in this institution is the department to teach the technology of the soul? There is life in the body, and it leaves at death. But what is it? What is the difference between the living and the dead? It was a proud, prestigious place of learning. But we knew you could answer every challenge. We watched the animals, whether they would jump, and in what way they would jump against you. All went well until the Indians surrounded you. They hadn't come to MIT to honor sadhus. But you held them off, grabbing one man's collar. If, as you say, everything is one, then why don't you wear a cotton ball instead of a shirt? Intimate talks in the back seat. Was it all right? You asked as the car drove up Memorial Drive. In recalling, you again became angry and amused at the arrogant men who could never understand the difference between the living and the dead. Harvard Divinity students and teachers heard in their own way, but that you spoke there was important. When they called you a teacher of Hindu thought, immediately you corrected them. In a complimenting, humble way, you addressed the Boston Brahmins. Harvard students were gold, you said, but if they would add Krishna consciousness, they would be gold with a sweet aroma. You were regal and power-packed, sitting enwrapped by your chadar on an improvised asana atop the desk. And they were exposing, with their foolish questions, that Harvard men and women don't know anything about the absolute truth, but at least they saw you as a saint and a scholar. Entering the storefront full of people, you were pleased and ready. A woman asked about happiness in this world. You said it wasn't possible. You wanted to enlighten her and others lost in sentimental body concepts of yoga, expecting the Swami to teach mystic techniques for a service of sex and money. Bhagavatam culture they didn't want, and your strong assertions turned them away. You shouted, "There is no happiness here. With repeated birth, death, disease, and old age, where is happiness?" This reduced your audience, but you didn't care. You spoke to dispel illusion, demanding surrender to Krishna. At my desk in the Roxbury Welfare Office, I studied the calendar, counting my fortune, a month of your lectures. I waited for the evening when we would sing with you and hear you speak. On a Friday night, as you were going out the door, you looked my way. "Satsvarup, tomorrow you have no work, so you can come and see me." To be selected by your glance and words, I jumped for joy. Our month of fortune dwindled down to a last day, and suddenly we were on our own, feeling fortified by your philosophical mind and your commitment to preaching in Boston. Montreal, summer 1968. At the temple, a former bowling alley, Prabhupada lectured from a high seat beside a banner of the Hare Krishna mantra. He also sent some books to the printer and worked on getting U.S. residency. He spoke to the Christians and wrote a letter to the Pope, "I think we should meet together and chalk out a program." These are some signposts in his preaching life, but no one can know the mind of the Vaishnava. We have his words and books, his living followers, and these all carry his teachings. His teachings are the greatest gift. Even those who utter God in reverence cannot know unless they hear from him exactly how God is great. For lack of that science, millions cannot believe and cannot understand why there is evil in the world or why they should control their lust. He set the example of a pure devotional life. Therefore, we want to remember him. The Road to England. During lectures, he used to say, "I could pass away at any moment." It was a way of prompting us to become mature and share the burden, thinking that at any moment we would have to do it without his personal presence. He pushed ahead at a rapid pace to print the books, open the temples, initiate, and send disciples throughout the world. In that enthusiastic mood, he sent three couples to London. "Be bold," he said, as in the Charlie Chaplin movie where a man who had his coattails ripped pretended it was the latest style, inspiring all the other dancers to follow. Though the English might think the devotees mad, they should go on chanting. Others would soon follow. Seattle, October 1968, on the occasion of the passing away of Bhakti Pragya Keshava Maharaj, the sannyas guru of Srila Prabhupada. Prabhupada was in Seattle at the time, reading from the teachings of Lord Chaitanya and speaking for hours each night for his students and Mayas. In a room converted into a temple with Jagannath deities on the altar, and the American Sankirtan party at his feet, eager to be there. The program over for the night, he returned to his room to find a telegram. "Bhakti Pragya Keshava Maharaj has passed away." Immediately composing a Sanskrit verse, he returned to the temple, although it was late, to instruct his followers about separation from the Guru. He played a taped bhajan and then informed them, "The person who gave me sannyas has left his body." Prabhupada wept, remembering his own beloved Guru, Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur, who had come to him in dreams, asking him to take sannyas. Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati was the one, but through him a god brother, Keshava Maharaj, had brought the message. Prabhupada had been alone in Vrindavan when this god brother had insisted, "Bhakti Vedanta, you must take sannyas." Vairagya Vidya Nija Bhakti Yogam Apaya Yamam Anavishnu Andham Sri Keshava Bhakti Pragyanam. Devotional service is the way of renunciation. I was unwilling like one blind, but he forcefully made me drink the medicine. His name is Sri Keshava Bhakti Pragya Maharaj. "He has entered Krishna's abode," said Prabhupada, and his little band in Seattle, awed by the spiritual emotions and the parampara mysteries, and especially thrilled that Prabhupada was sharing with them, duly signed the letter of condolence and praise to be sent to Navadvip. In America, 1969. To Santa Fe, where your secretary thought the altitude would be bad for your health, so at the airport she tried to turn you back. She was flustered and crying, "Prabhupada, you know Krishna. What does Krishna want us to do?" But you retorted, "No, Krishna wants to know what you are going to do." Finally, you decided to ride under a clear sky with high white clouds to the Albuquerque Center, where you shared Ladus and Krishna Katha with the hippie meditators who suddenly came down from the mountains at the hour you arrived to Los Angeles, where your devotees were nightly holding kirtans in the thick of Hollywood Boulevard, but who were soon evicted from their ideal location. For weeks they were scattered, and you lectured in different garages, until finally you purchased the best building so far, a wooden church on La Cienega. You planted 108 rose bushes, and a special era of burgeoning began, with hundreds attending the weekly feasts, with ecstatic kirtans and back to Godhead sales, and a festive, loving family of devotees. Meanwhile, you wrote in Beverly Hills, turning out two books at once, The Nectar of Devotion and Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. To Columbus, Ohio, where you conversed with Allen Ginsberg, who was looking for a more American mantra. "Krishna is everything," you said. "He is universal." And you proved it the next night, as 2,000 students in the All-American City chanted, jumping up on the seats, dancing in the aisles, crying out, grabbing for your throne flowers as you led them, "Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare." To New Vrindavan, where you behaved as if you had always lived there, walking the 2-mile road through the woods as if you were at home, stepping on stones to cross the creek, accompanied by Kirtanananda Swami, through thick forest and blue flocks. To the old house on the New Vrindavan Ridge. You entered for the first time, but as if just coming back from a walk. To the room, to the chair where you sat, declaring this the best way to live. There was no need, you said, to live in the city at the terrible cost of factory labor, producing the unnecessary objects of sense gratification. Man can live simply, depending on nature, from the fields, his food, from the cows, nutritious milk, and save time for chanting Hare Krishna. You drank the milk of the black cow, Kaliya, sat at a low desk under the persimmon tree, lived in an attic room with your Radha Krishna deities, accepted simple corn cereal, pokeweed, blackberry chutney, and spoke on the philosophy of Varnashram Dharma, yourself the personification of simple living and high thinking. A month passed in the backwoods. Grasses grew untrampled by civilization as you daily fashioned your Bhagavatam purports, bathed outdoors, read and walked and breathed outdoors, and spoke with your men of many plans. Little mail and no phone could reach you, but gradually the messages arrived. Your presence was greatly needed throughout the U.S. and Europe. To Los Angeles again, where you installed golden Radha Krishna deities. They stood for darshan on their velvet canopied throne and began to receive worship with 6 daily offerings. Should the devotees ever lose enthusiasm, you said, the worship would become idolatry. But where there was life, then Krishna, this very Krishna, will talk with you. To San Francisco, where you accompanied Jagannath, Baladev, and Subhadra during Ratha Yatra through Golden Gate Park. At a low bridge, the cart stopped because its super mechanical collapsible dome failed to lower. While the men tried, 1,000 chanters sang under the stone bridge, creating a tremendous echo. You stood at the front of the cart, raised your arms to the people, and began to dance, jumping up and down, causing the crowd to jump with you as flowers tumbled from your broken garland and the chanting became a roar. When the cart moved on through the park, 10,000 people were following you, and they were fed from 10,000 plates of prasadam, halava, chutney, and fruits. Chant, dance, and take prasadam, you advised the multitude. And even if you do not hear the teachings, you will be elevated to the topmost platform of perfection. Hamburg, August 1968. The history was touching. Shivananda went there alone, inexperienced, and Prabhupada wrote him, "I came to New York in the same helpless way. Don't be disappointed. I am always with you." On Eppendorf Weg, a plate glass window painted blue in an oval, Radha Krishna Temple, International Gesellschaft für Krishna Bewussten V. Prabhupada's secretary was morose. "Why did we have to come here, where it's cold and gray, and stay in a small room in the middle of the city?" But Shivananda was in bliss. "Prabhupada is here just to give us mercy of his personal association." And Prabhupada was also in bliss, but serious. He spoke for hours with the boys and guests, giving practical suggestions on how they could increase. "Perform Sankirtan," he said. "Collect your funds from selling magazines. Learn the language and preach." There were only 4 devotees, and he spent Janmashtami and Vyas Puja with them. The major events on Janmashtami were that Prabhupada shaved his head, and that they sat with him until midnight and then enjoyed a feast. On his birthday, he received in the mail a Vyas Puja book with the prayers of his many devotees. "You are providing for me," he said. "What can I do? I can simply pray to Krishna for you, but don't be satisfied that you have understood. This knowledge should be distributed." On cold morning walks, he observed the German people, saw the ditch diggers drinking beer in the morning, saw the ads for Zigaretten, talked several times with blonde Professor Bernhardt, who studied Vaishnavism with distaste, and he showed Shivananda how to cook and massage. Shivananda was apologetic. "Hamburg must not be very good for you. There's nobody here." "That's all right," Prabhupada smiled. Preaching sometimes brought him to decorated halls where hundreds loved his name, and sometimes to a park where 10,000 followed, chanting. But sometimes he was quite alone, stared at in a hostile way by ditch diggers, or insulted at the home of a Christian professor. "We are doing our preaching work," he said. Heaven or hell made no difference to him. All that mattered was Krishna and being able to preach. London arrival, September 11, 1969. As a child, he had heard about the city. had stood with a flag by the roadside in Calcutta as King George V in a gilded carriage had passed by. Buckingham Palace and the River Thames, he had thought, must be great objects of the imperial crown. But he found the Queen's Palace smaller than many houses in Calcutta, and the Thames, a canal, much smaller than the Ganges. His father had told him not to go there. His spiritual master had prepared him. Both instructions were the same. He was not coming to London to be like the British. "I have come to teach what you have forgotten." "Which is what?" snapped the reporter. The pressmen's cameras were clicking. "That is God," Prabhupada said, full of challenge. "Any nonsense can come to me. I shall prove there is God." After a hard year, his disciples had met the Fabulous Four, the immortal Beatles, and George Harrison had become their friend. He had been playing Prabhupada's record, and he liked to chant. They had made an Apple record, Hare Krishna Mantra, with thousands of copies selling daily. Prabhupada would stay at John Lennon's in exchange for his disciples' work. Prabhupada in the servants' quarters, while John and Yoko roamed the mansion. As soon as Prabhupada arrived in the rain, George, John, and Yoko came to his room. "We can't accept authority," John said. "We don't follow anything," said Yoko. And George said, "We accept Krishna as God, but not your translation of the Gita as the only one." "Oh, you accept Krishna as God," said Prabhupada. "So if that is accepted, then you should follow that person who is most addicted to Krishna. How can he who doesn't utter even the name of Krishna become his representative?" The English rain came down. He was not nervous talking to the superstars. He saw them as foolish youngsters. Yet as a devotee, he was respectful, even to the ant. Speaking expertly of Krishna, peace, music, and death, he told how President Kennedy was much applauded, but had died in a second. And where is he now? Is he reborn in China? Has he returned to America? Where is he? Prabhupada gave a warning to John and George that they too, although wonderfully famous, could be cut off at any moment, and he snapped his finger loudly. Suddenly, Kennedy had been finished. "We also may be forced. And where do we go? What is the soul's destination?" The superstars quibbled from no real position except their proud youth and ignorant worldly success. Prabhupada invited them nevertheless. "Try it, and the peace you yearn for can be achieved." At the Lennon's estate. 6 devotees, 3 husbands and their wives, the group who had startled London with chanting, who had done more in London in 1 year than the Gaudiya Math sannyasis had in 30, gathered for a reunion with Prabhupada. He was an affectionate leader, accepting the women's cooking and flowers, while charging the men with heavy duties. "Get permission to occupy the downtown center and transform it into a temple. Go every day," he told them. Obediently, they took his order as just what they needed. The tall grass was wet, but Prabhupada liked to walk in the morning, through the morning mist, through the orchards, gullies, and lawn expanses, wearing black coat, black Cossack hat, black boots, sometimes silently chanting, sometimes speaking of Krishna. Yellowed grasses cut off at the root, he compared to souls disconnected from Krishna. The British economy, due to karma, he said, was sinking into the sea. In the distance, John Lennon watched from his house. The waning of Purushottam Das. In London, during the second manned U.S. moon landing, one of Prabhupada's disciples became doubtful, hearing him say the landing was a hoax. But most of us had no trouble accepting the logic that Shastra is perfect, our senses are imperfect, so we tend to make mistakes, become illusioned, and cheat. We don't even know who we are. In a talk with an L.A. reporter regarding whether men with no pious credits could actually go to the moon, Prabhupada had said they could not. But what if they do go? What will you say? Wherever they go, it is not Chandraloka. He didn't argue. The landing was staged in a Las Vegas desert. But he explained, according to Vedic scriptures, the moon is a heavenly planet. You can go there only when your karma is right. As when entering a foreign land, you need a visa. It is a waste of time, said Prabhupada. Better to become Krishna conscious. We must go beyond this universe to where life is never followed by death. Did they go? Yes, we went, they say. Here is the movie, and here are the rocks. But who has gained? Are the moon walkers immortal for rocketing out and returning with a splash? Who has learned to love God? Since we have conquered the other planet, we no longer believe in God, the moon men say. But do they really know? We know for sure. Prabhupada in London watched the moon landing on TV and ate khichdi with his disciples. Malati, he said, has done far more valuable service than they by making some khichdi for Krishna. Why should we doubt our spiritual master or the scriptures in favor of whom? But Purushottam, the same secretary who had been morose in Hamburg, was more morose in London. He stopped shaving his face because of the moon, stopped changing his clothes, and finally fell away. He lost his one chance in a million lifetimes to serve the pure devotee because of the moon. Prabhupada tried to save him in a light, joking way. Today, Purushottam has gone to the moon. Why not? Anyone can go. But Purushottam didn't smile. He thought the American scientists knew well what they are doing. He began to think, again, that his body was himself. Snakes in his head, envy, doubt, lust, and fear began to stir. He got the idea to go back to a normal life of drinking beer, going to school, calling himself a Christian, and believing in the moonshot. He gave up his way of life and went away because of the moon. I can understand, said Prabhupada, that he might not accept it because I said it, but how could he disbelieve the Shastra? The Radha Krishna Temple of London. Shyamasundar was the delay. He had a grand conception to build a temple room like the Ajanta caves, but in redwood instead of stone. Prabhupada let him do it, but after months, when still it wasn't done, Prabhupada insisted, "We will open in 2 weeks, print the invitations." Before his room was ready, Prabhupada moved into the city and directed the daily affairs. The deities of Radha and Krishna came in a special way. It was the trick of Krishna, Prabhupada said. Just as Krishna tricked his mother Yasoda, not allowing her to bind him, and at Kurukshetra he sometimes played a chivalrous or diplomatic battle trick. So, Prabhupada saw the trick of the Lord in London. Krishna had had himself transported from India by a London Hindu society, and in transit they chipped a very small piece of Radharani's finger. On custom, the Hindus had hesitated to install the chipped deity, and they had phoned to see whether Prabhupada was interested. Before they knew it, Krishna was carried away in the arms of Prabhupada's men. With his permission, Krishna was embraced by the pure devotee. Excitedly, Prabhupada brought the deities to his room and ordered Yamuna to sew saffron garments for the grand opening of the Radha Krishna Temple of London. The Lord, his consort, and their pure devotee, who brings the divine pair together to be worshipped, and who brings the fallen souls before them, this is the most merciful of unions. Shyamasundar was to blame for the canopies almost crashing down on the deities during the installation. The pillar and canopy weren't secure. He had worked so hard and had finally collapsed before the last important detail was done. But when the canopy began to slip and the heavy pillars tilted, Prabhupada jumped and saved the deities, putting his arms above their heads and grabbing the pillars, leaving Radha and Krishna standing safely on the marble altar. On the opening of the Radha Krishna Temple of London, Krishna consciousness West leaped forward, protected by the mind and strong arms of the Lord's pure devotee. Only he could sense the deepest meaning of the triumph of bringing the people relief from the oceans of birth and death. All glories to Radha London Ishvara. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. ISKCON Press, Boston, December 1969. The press was in Boston, and Prabhupada agreed to visit. The devotees there were worshipping very small Radha Krishna deities in an old house in the suburb of Alston. 150 devotees were on hand from various East Coast temples. At the airport, people could hardly believe the intensity of the reception for the Swami. It was as if the Beatles had arrived. The devotees were also amazed. Prabhupada was so great, coming from London, wearing a white wool sweater and carrying a white plastic attaché case, smiling to see his disciples, his right arm upraised, his bead bag wrapped around his hand. He was pleased with both the temple and the press, but in the press room he embraced the devotee printer. "This is the heart of ISKCON," Prabhupada said, standing beside the offset press. "You are the heart of ISKCON," a devotee cried. "And this is my heart," Prabhupada replied. The basement was like a chilly cave, but filled with precious goods, printed pages of his books in dozens of stacks, ready to be folded, cut, collated, and bound. He loved the press that printed Krishna's books, and he appealed to those who were helping him to work hard at producing those books, type them, edit them, paint pictures for them, compose them, lay out the pages, or be the wife of a press worker and peacefully raise children, or be the printer, the collator, the hand binder, or for extra mercy, go to the front lines and distribute the books, but somehow or other work with the books and know the greatest nectar. That was the open secret he conveyed that night, as the ISKCON press workers already knew. This is the major Sankirtan party, as the street chanting is heard a block away by the sound of the thumping madrunga, so the press is the big madrunga to be heard all over the world. As he stood in the cellar, he made a pact. "Print my books, at least one every 2 months, and you will go back to Godhead. We have unlimited stock. I can translate more, if I can get time, and if you can produce them. This is the field work of our movement. Temple worship is secondary." This was the thing most dear to him.